This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas. Judy Jacek, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here.
I said to you a moment ago that out of the almost 1,000 interviews I've done, you are the first vet.
Yeah, and I said, somehow it doesn't really surprise me. Seems like veterinarians don't like to be so outspoken or going against the grain. Seems like it's hard for people to go against the grain sometimes, and that seems to be more of a trend in veterinary medicine.
I should have said veterinarian, not vet, because sometimes I guess you might think it has to do with war, but...
Right. can be easily confused, yeah.
In many respects, though, you're dealing with big pharma. There kind of is a war, isn't there?
It feels like it to me. You know, when you see what's really going on, you know, veterinary medicine is we're the same industry as, you know, human big pharma. We just have branches. Like, we have a company called Zoetis, for example, that's like the veterinary branch of Pfizer. So we have the same influences, and trying to get the information out. And I sometimes feel like I'm at war with the whole profession. A lot of clients come into me. I do primarily telemedicine now because I do more specialized nutrition, herbs. I don't do so much the primary hands-on care anymore. I work with a lot of cancer patients, a lot of pets with cancer. And the stories I hear coming out of the conventional veterinary world are, I just shake my head. I feel like the profession's becoming really incompetent, and in their use of pharmaceuticals, diagnostic testing, without even really looking at the patient. People come to me and say, do you treat such and such disease? And I say, well, I treat your pet. We get so hung up on the lab values that are the testing. I mean, that's what conventional vets really treat. They're looking at the lab results, and it's pretty algorithmic. Medicine's become pretty algorithmic, where there's a certain diagnostic test, and then there's a associated treatment protocol. So if they don't have those test results, they don't even know what to do. Whereas I can have a pet come in with no testing. I mean, health to me is incredibly simple. It's about correcting nutrition, making sure they're on good quality, species appropriate nutrition, which for dogs and cats should be on meat-based fresh diets, and eliminating toxicity, which includes pharmaceuticals and environmental toxins and EMF and all the things that affect people. And, you know, that's it. But to undo, you know, the past history is sometimes challenging, and just getting people to understand that this really is all we need to do, and to get people away from the, I need the antibiotic, or I need the anti-diarrheal, or I need the conventional medicine is anti-medicine. We're always like fighting a symptom. Whereas I take more of a terrain approach, where the symptoms we're seeing are actually the body trying to heal. And if we look at it from that perspective and support that process, then we're going to end up helping our pets' health much more. But it's not a common paradigm, common way of thinking.
What is your background?
I went to Colorado State University, graduated in 1988, and I started out in conventional practice, stayed in the Western United States. I was in Idaho for a few years, moved to Utah for a few years, and then I had family in Colorado, so I moved back to Colorado and was there for, we left Colorado just last year. We moved to Tennessee. So I was in Colorado for about 22 years. And during that time in Colorado, kind of that phase, after I was in like probably 8 to 10 years into veterinary medicine, I just started seeing there's got to be something more we can do for our pets. I remember hearing the term once, vaccinarian, like, yeah, we're kind of being trained to be vaccinarians. Like, that's what practice was. You know, the pharmaceutical rep comes in and they buy the clinic lunch and they tell you all these things that you can be prescribing and how to get your clients to buy them based on fear, and then how much money you can make selling them. And everything was fear and profit. I'm just looking at the pets, like, but our pets are not getting healthier. You know, for all the advances that are occurring in medicine, and there's been a lot of, you know, diagnostic advances, things like you know, echocardiograms for the heart and ultrasounds and surgical advances, you know, things that were really, really valuable. But despite all that, our pets aren't getting healthier over time. They're just getting sicker and more from the chronic illness standpoint. They're just not thriving. You can just see it. And I'm just kind of, that was my wake up call. Like, there's got to be something more. And I think it was a case, once you open yourself up to a new way of thinking, the universe starts to provide you information. So from that point, people came into my life that, you know, helped me learn more about fresh food nutrition. And I started studying things like herbal medicine and homeopathy. And then once I started instituting these things in my practice, well, I mean, that was it. You just saw my patients get healthier and healthier and healthier. I started vaccinating less, using fewer pharmaceuticals, using more natural approach, supporting the terrain. And the pets just got healthier and healthier. And I learned from my clients, because I would attract people in that were feeding raw food diets, and they'd come in feeding raw. And I'd learn from them. I asked them, what are you doing? How are you doing this? Because their pets looked fantastic. And then once you see those results, then, you know, there's just no going back. And so over the years, then I've kind of, I'd say I've become more and more like laser focused in my practice. I do now work with a lot of cancer patients, but people have to be willing to follow our nutritional recommendations. I don't work with patients that are also doing chemotherapy, because you can't be supporting the body and poisoning the body at the same time. And so I think I've gotten more and more laser focused in that approach to medicine. And now where I'd really like to be going is I'd like to support more vets in thinking this way. Like I was saying before, it's a little hard sometimes for practitioners to step outside the box. Once veterinarians get out of school and they have that license, and it's like the almighty license, that's the big fear thing. Well, if I don't practice, you know, a certain way, I could lose my license. But the medical licenses really are handcuffs. They really tie you towards practicing a certain way. What I would like to do now, because I can do just so much and help just so many pets, I'd like to help encourage more veterinarians to think this way. And I've learned a lot from the business perspective, you know, kind of the life of hard knocks, a lot of trial and error. So I'd like to help other veterinarians learn that they can practice on a small scale. There's outlets for practicing this way. A lot of vets are now getting trapped in corporate veterinary medicine. There's a big corporate takeover. Big corporations like Mars are buying up lots and lots and lots of veterinary clinics. And the vets, they come out of school, they got a high debt load into these corporate clinics, they make a good salary, they get benefits, but they can't practice authentically or an individual basis. They're dictated to by what the parent corporation says. And that's just all based on profit. So I'd really like to help develop a way to help more vets see this way of approaching their patients and then realize that they can't actually do that in practice. I'm actually working with a foundation. It's called the Anthroposophia Foundation, which is based in anthroposophic medicine, which was developed by Rudolf Steiner back in the 1920s, primarily on the human side. But this particular foundation is wanting to develop a veterinary education program. And so kind of just getting started working with them, because I feel like I can help a whole lot more pets by educating the veterinarians. And I know there's going to be a lot of frustrated veterinarians out there. I'd like to see more vets actually enjoy practice again.
Anthroposophic, what does that mean?
That was a term actually created by Rudolf Steiner back in the 1920s. And it's basically, it's a mind-body-spirit approach to healing. So it's essentially holistic medicine. I don't know exactly where that particular word came from, but the approach is that you look at all aspects of the human, or in this case, the pet, but including physical, mental, emotional, environmental, energetic, all the different aspects of the human or of the pet. And so it hasn't really been applied so much to veterinary medicine, but I like the idea of kind of creating a trend that has a little different name than just holistic medicine, because there's a lot of vets that consider themselves holistic practitioners that really aren't. Like, they're basically conventional, and they might throw in a little acupuncture or a little chiropractic or something like that, but they don't have the true holistic philosophy where we're looking at the whole being, and that's what we're treating. That's the foundation of anthroposophic medicine, is that we look at the whole being and we don't just throw pharmaceuticals at symptoms. In even in holistic medicine, you know, you can throw supplements at symptoms too, and herbs at symptoms too. You know, it's not all that different from using the pharmaceutical approach, just using herbs instead of pharmaceuticals. It's not really treating the whole animal.
So it's preventative rather than reactive.
Yeah, essentially. That's where we want to be. I mean, you know, sometimes, you know, if I'm working with a cancer patient, they're pretty far down the road. So we're doing playing a lot of catch up. I'd rather be starting with a puppy or kitten and doing prevention from that point on. But, you know, sometimes we have to, you know, just support the body as best we can and help it to heal. And the body has an amazing ability to heal. Nature is perfect in the way things are set up. And it's really all these interventions from the human side that tend to mess up that healing process.
So what happened? I mean, what caused your Damascus moment? I mean, why did you go from conventional establishment veterinary science to not?
I mean, it wasn't in an instant. It was a process.
Right.
And like I was saying before, I just started seeing that pets weren't getting healthier and that veterinarians were really being trained to be pawns for the pharmaceutical industry. We're being trained to be drug dealers in a sense, you know, sell the pharmaceuticals, sell the, you know, vaccines, do all of that stuff. The diets, the whole prescription diet industry is just horrific for pets. Those are leases like your Hills and Royal Canin and these big brands that sell these so-called prescription diets. There's nothing prescription about them. They just are sold at the veterinary office exclusively, so they're more expensive. That just didn't sit well with me, feeling like, okay, I'm just becoming a drug pusher. Not that there are sometimes there's times where a pharmaceutical may be indicated, but that's not my primary approach. And so it was a process because I didn't want to make my patients guinea pigs. So I started learning and then slowly introducing other modalities and then just started seeing my patients' health improve. It was just like a no-brainer.
You said other modalities. So I'm guessing pharmaceutical would be considered a modality, right? What other modalities are you talking about?
I mean, nutrition is huge. I mean, just like in people, we need to, we need to eat appropriately. And the same thing, we need to be feeding our pets appropriately. So nutrition is a huge foundation there. But then from there, herbal medicine. I do a lot with Chinese herbal medicine, which is an ancient practice. You know, it's been around thousands of years, and where there's herbal blends that
in pets,
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yep. And there's actually quite a bit of education now in Chinese herbal medicine. There's a organization in Florida, it's the Qi Institute, and they do a lot of online and on-site training in veterinary traditional Chinese medicine. And so these herbal blends that are based on these old ancient formulas can really help correct imbalances in the body. And then, of course, Western herbs. So I use a lot of plant medicine. Homeopathy is another wonderful modality. I wouldn't say that's my highest area of expertise, but there are some wonderful homeopathic veterinarians that I'll sometimes refer cases to for input there. And then, other additive things, energy medicine, like plant, there's plant energetics, like your flower essences and essential oils that are more using the energetic essences from the plants therapeutically. Pretty much anything that, you know, comes from nature can have healing capabilities. And also, I think what gets overlooked in our pets a lot is their lifestyle. You know, somebody has a pet, say in the city, and they're mainly walked on sidewalks and asphalt. Their feet aren't touching the ground. You know, you've probably heard about the importance of grounding for people. Get out, get barefoot on the ground, touch the grass. Well, a dog or, you know, a cat that's in the city, their feet may not touch the ground very much. And I think it's really important to look at, are they living a lifestyle that's appropriate for them as a species, because they're still dogs and cats and they're not, you know, they're not people in fursuits. So I think we have to look at that. That's kind of the emotional aspect to pet healthcare.
It runs the risk of sounding quite woo-woo, but I mean, is there quite a great or good success rate with this alternative approach?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I'd have to say I don't have a full concept of how many pets that I can actually help. You know, it's probably a tiny, tiny percentage of the overall pet population. But I hear from my clients all the time that pets that say, you know, had a cancer diagnosis and were given just a few months to live are years on down the road. It doesn't happen all the time, but it definitely can happen with this approach. And just in, you know, my own dog, I mean, we have a house on 10 acres. We moved to Tennessee from Colorado last year, and we have a German Shepherd. He's an 8-month-old pup. And, you know, he's out running around just, you know, loving life. I mean, of course, we do training and stuff, but he gets to run around a lot and just be a dog. And I just think if you take a high energy breed and they're living in the city and they don't have the proper outlets for, like, different breeds have different instincts. Like you have your herding breeds and your shepherd's a working breed. They want stuff to do. They're not really designed to just lay around the house. And so you have to provide them the outlets, and you can certainly do that living in the city, but just have to make a conscious effort to get them up, do activities, do nose work or agility or something that those breeds really, really enjoy.
Your approach is to be preventative. But now, what actually happens when a dog has something like cancer or parvo or rabies? These are supposedly physiological or biological situations. You would think that they would then require the same type of response. But you're suggesting no.
When it comes to cancer, first of all, cancer, I think, is fundamentally toxicity. It's a toxic response in the body where the cells, it's like a kind of survival mechanism. The cells are trying to wall off toxins and they just become so sick and so toxic. And that's what cancer is. So correcting that toxic load is really what treating cancer is all about. That's why I'm not a proponent of things like chemotherapy, because we're just poisoning the body further. And the typical chemotherapy approach is not doing anything to support the patient. Oncologists don't talk about providing good nutrition or other things to help support the healing ability of the body. And the whole body ends up being poisoned. So by correcting nutrition, eliminating toxins, that can go a long way. Now, when I start with the cancer patient, sometimes they're pretty far down the road and sometimes we can't get ahead of it. We start talking about things like parvo and rabies. You know, I did the rabies interview on Solari, and I'm actually now in the camp that I don't think viruses exist. You know, that's been pretty well proven that what we're being told is evidence that viruses exist, like pictures on the electron microscope are in fact just artifacts of the processing. They take tissue samples, and anything that's taken out of the body and put on a slide to look at under the microscope, it's not in its natural state. So it's assumed that what we're looking at under the microscope is the same thing that's in the body, but in fact, it's not, because it's dried, for one, usually treated with chemicals, chemical stains and things like that. So what we're seeing under the microscope is nothing like what's actually going on in the body. And in fact, I think what's called viruses is, again, just toxicity. And that's been proven for a number of human viruses, such as polio. Polio has been linked to DDT. Rabies, you know, there was never any sound proof that the rabies virus existed. It was kind of all created by Louis Pasteur. Things like parvo, there's a test for parvo, and I've seen many puppies with this bloody diarrhea that do test positive for it. I think there's probably something false in that test. You know, we learned a lot about the false testing and inaccurate test results throughout COVID. So I think it's probably also some toxicity. I'm not sure what, but I personally am convinced at this point that this whole viral paradigm is made up, and it's really just to cover up how badly we're being poisoned and our pets are being poisoned.
So what you're suggesting then is that a rabies could be some sort of environmental trigger that leads to some weird kind of psychotic moment, and parvo could also be potentially environmentally triggered.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about, well, parvo, you know, so yes, I've seen many of these puppies that have this horrible bloody diarrhea and vomiting. The puppies eat everything. I mean, they got their noses down eating everything, and use of things like glyphosate, which is, you know, a powerful herbicide that's been known to be very hard on the gut. I think toxicities like that. Sometimes puppies even vaccinated for parvo will get parvo. So I do think it's some sort of toxin that the puppies are picking up. The rabies, supposed rabies symptoms where dogs become aggressive, they salivate. And there's lots of reasons why dogs can become aggressive. And for the dogs that have shown those symptoms, you know, once there's an assumption that it could be something like rabies, the pets are usually euthanized. They don't look any further into, well, was that pet abused? Was it fed properly and treated? I mean, you take any dog and don't treat them kindly and abuse them, they're going to be aggressive. Toxins will cause this excessive salivation. That's also been linked to rabies. So yeah, there can be many things that can cause the same symptoms. It's just once the virus, so-called virus, is named, then that paradigm seems to stick. And it sticks because of fear. You know, fear is very powerful selling point. Sells a lot of vaccines and a lot of pharmaceuticals.
Over the last few years, my view on vaccines has completely flipped, turned on its head. I don't approve or trust any vaccine at all, at least when we're talking about humans. But does that same principle then apply to pets? If vaccines don't have a good history with humans, do they also not have a good history with dogs?
I think pets would be much healthier without all the vaccinations, for sure. And I see, you know, I work with a lot of cancer patients, and I always look at their vaccine history. And many of them, not all, but many of them have had like full rounds of vaccinations within 6 months of their cancer diagnosis. It's like it's the final straw. And it's usually they're, you know, a few years old. And that's another thing, is I'm seeing cancer in younger and younger patients, which makes me really suspicious of the vaccinations, because they're coming out with mRNA vaccines now for pets. And I've seen, you know, dogs as young as like 1 to 3 years now getting cancer. And that used to be unheard of. But we're seeing that same trend in humans, you know, with all the onslaught of the, you know, the COVID vaccines and how they're pushing vaccines on children. We're seeing an uptick in cancer. And I think it's probably the same vaccine technology. I mean, there's no truth in labeling in this stuff. And I mean, who knows what they're putting in these vaccines? They're not telling us the truth. And I don't think that in veterinary medicine anyway, I don't think that veterinarians often question it. They just believe what they're being told by the pharmaceutical company. If you don't vaccinate your patients, they could get sick, and then you're going to be liable. It comes back to this liability and the fear of the lawsuit, or the fear of not practicing in a way that could threaten their license, or practicing in a way that could threaten their license. So that's the fear factor for the veterinarians. Do I think pets are healthier without vaccines? Without question. I don't think we need to worry about all these diseases. If we focus on proper nutrition, proper lifestyle, all these things we're talking about, I don't think we need to worry about all the vaccinations.
But do you see a correlation at all between vaccinated and unvaccinated puppies with regards to parvo?
I would say that I have seen, and I think we have to really be careful about correlation and causation. So I would say that in the cases that I have tested, you know, in practice, like I'd see these puppies come in and I would do the parvo test, and I would definitely see some test negative, some test positive. And I would definitely see the ones that were not vaccinated test positive. However, what else could be going on there? Now I'm asking this question. So yes, I have observed that. But now that I'm rethinking this whole viral theory, well, what else could be going on? So a lot of the times, the reason people don't vaccinate their puppies is they're lower income. They're not taking them into the vet. So those puppies are also probably not getting good nutrition. Maybe they're not in a a healthy environment. Maybe they're more likely to be exposed to these toxins. And then something's showing up on the test. I've been buying Parvo tests and I'm testing different things to see if I can trigger a positive test on different chemicals and just different things to see what's really showing up on that test. So have I seen a correlation between like some positive tests and unvaccinated? Yes, but it's also true that that's not 100%. I've also definitely seen some vaccinated puppies get, you know, test positive for parvo. But I think we need to be looking at the possibility that, okay, if this isn't a virus, what else could it be? You know, what else could our pets be being exposed to?
Yeah, it does seem like the pharmaceutical industry creates a single cause with a single solution when it could simply be a multitude of causes with a multitude of solutions.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I think it is. It's a combination of, you know, nutrition, environmental toxicity, just like the same things that make humans sick. And well, the other thing about parvo is I think parvo became known in the mid to later 1970s. What, it just popped out of nowhere, you know? So I think back to what else was going on, what else was introduced, what other toxins were dogs exposed to, you know, back then that might have been a contributing factor to this vomiting and diarrhea. Because if you look at from a terrain theory perspective, the puppies will vomit and have diarrhea when they're trying to purge something, they're trying to get something out of their bodies. Now that's been attributed to a virus, but could be lots of other things. And I think we need to be drilling down and looking at all potential causes, not just saying, well, that's what it is. It's that virus, because we're going to miss the other stuff.
But unfortunately, when the puppy is going through those convulsions, he's likely going to die.
Well, with parvo, I've actually found parvo to be pretty treatable. If you can keep them hydrated, they just get so terribly dehydrated that most puppies that I saw that I would have considered to have parvo, if you just could hospitalize them and really run the fluids to them and keep them really well hydrated, the majority, probably 90%, would actually survive. Today, well, I don't run into too many parvo puppies anymore, but the ones that I see that end up hospitalized that don't do well, I think they're poisoned with the pharmaceuticals. I look at like the treatment protocols, and these puppies are on 10 or 12 different pharmaceuticals while they're hospitalized. And in my mind, that's not necessary. Having treated a lot of these puppies, if you really push the fluids and keep them hydrated, and then you got to let the body purge what it needs to purge.
Judy, is there a place for pharmaceuticals in pet healthcare?
I think sometimes in the very short term, pain medication, working with a lot of cancer patients, sometimes there's a lot of pain. And so I wouldn't deprive an animal pain medication if we couldn't control the pain naturally. I would always try natural means, things like CBD and body work and things like that. If the pain is uncontrollable, I wouldn't deprive them of that anymore. I think antibiotics probably do more harm than good. So I think probably the biggest, I would say, need for conventional medicine and pharmaceuticals is in the true emergency. Pet gets hit by a car, they're bleeding, they're going to go in, they need to be stabilized. You got to do what you got to do. You got to treat them for shock. They might need surgery. They're going to have to get a lot of drugs. They're going to have anesthesia, maybe antibiotics in the very short term if there's a bad, you know, contaminated wound or something like that. But long-term use of antibiotics, I don't ever advocate for that. I mean, I think we have to look at what's the body telling us, you know? If a pet's vomiting, well, that's trying to get something out, you know? Can it get it out? Can we just support it? Sometimes the pet just needs to not eat. People panic sometimes if their pet misses a meal. Sometimes that's just their body needs just a short fast. And that's their body trying to heal, but people get really concerned about that, run them into the vet, and the vet gives an appetite stimulant or something like that, where sometimes they just need to fast for 24 hours.
How important is diet? I mean, you mentioned Royal Canin and Hill's, and everybody knows those brands.
Oh, it's huge. It's the most important thing. I think all kibble, all dry food diets are horrific. They're all about 50% processed carbohydrate, which just turns into sugar. Kind of like feeding breakfast cereal. You know, we're to feed a human child Frosted Flakes, you know, and that's all they ever ate. That's about the nutritional component. Plus, there can be a lot of chemicals. A lot of these plant-based ingredients can be sprayed with glyphosate, which is highly toxic. None of these companies will talk to the sourcing on any of their ingredients. They have lots of synthetic nutrients in there. So yeah, I'm a big proponent of fresh food nutrition, and for dogs and cats, meat-based nutrition.
Raw food, is that probably the best?
That's my first recommendation. I'd have to say for some pets that are very sick, maybe that's a little harder transition to make, but that I always start there. I always start with a balanced raw diet, but it needs to be meat, bones, and organs. So you're modeling, you know, prey, you know, if a dog were to say kill a rabbit or a cat were to kill a mouse, you know, what does that look? Can we model the food blend off of the natural prey animal?
Do you think dogs and cats, I mean, when you talk about pets, that's pretty much what we mean, dogs and cats. Do you think dogs and cats today are better off? Are they healthier than what they were, say, 50, 60, 70 years ago?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think they're exposed to way more toxins. There's way more vaccines. I mean, I don't know exactly what vaccines are being given back then, but I don't even know if they were giving parvo back then. Like I said, I think parvo kind of came to be more like in the 1970s. And I bet, you know, pets were not getting the vaccines. And people fed more. His whole push to like, oh, don't feed people food. Just, you know, feed that bowl of kibble, feed the commercial food because it's complete and balanced. I think did pets a real disservice. You take your average pet that was dog was running around the farm or, you know, ranching dogs, things like that, just eating meat scraps. I mean, that's what dogs are meant to eat. They're natural scavengers. And so getting them indoctrinated into all the vaccines, always given pharmaceuticals and getting on these poor diets, I would say they're a lot less healthy. And I think also people need to learn too, like to recognize, you know, what maybe could be treated at home. Like, you know, just because a pet has one bout of diarrhea, well, that's just his body trying to cleanse something. They don't need to run them into the vet, but a lot of times they do. And they're put on antibiotics and then they end up, you know, getting sicker from the medications.
I had breakfast with my wife this morning and she made a great comment. And she said that dogs and cats are not really designed to live in the type of urban environments in which, you know, we find cities these days. Do you think that that has a big negative impact on their healthcare or on their health?
I think it can. If people are not aware of that and they're not making an effort to expose their pets to what they were meant to be doing. Dogs are meant to be out running, playing with other dogs. I mean, that's important. They need to have social outlets and yes, get out of the city. Just like it's not healthy for people to exclusively live in an urban environment. You know, human practitioners talk all the time. I mean, I don't think I've ever heard a human practitioner say like, don't go out into nature. That's a big thing for people. Get out into nature, get sunlight, get your feet on the ground. And I think those things are important for pets. Sure, you could live in the city, but you have to expose them to that outlet and those things that, you know, they're really meant to do as a species.
Paradoxically, the COVID era was precisely the opposite of what you just said. All the authorities and the experts told all of us to stay indoors, don't go outside, wear a mask, be unhealthy.
Right, absolutely. Oh, it didn't stop me. I was in Colorado at the time and they didn't close the hiking trails, so we still went out. I mean, it was kind of interesting, people's reactions at first. Normally when you're on the hiking trail and, you know, you pass everybody's friendly, you know, and it was really interesting because people would like back away, turn the other way, get like, you know, way far away from you at first. I mean, that faded away after a while, but I still got out. I know that that's so important for health.
Let's come down to a real world example. What are vets today doing wrong?
I think focusing on a diagnosis or a lab result rather than looking at the patient. Like, I mean, I've worked with people where kidney disease is a very common one. So they'll say, well, I've been told my pet, dog or cat's in kidney failure. And so I'll look at the lab results and say, okay, kidney values are a bit elevated. And then there'll be a stage, like a stage 2 or 3 or 4. And I'll say, well, how's your pet doing? Like, perfectly normal, perfectly fine. Changes in urination, to anything, drinking more water, nope, they're perfectly fine. So that hyper focus on the test result and not looking at the patient, I think that's the biggest error. And I think that's been lost in veterinary medicine. I don't think it used to be that way, but I think that's been lost because there's just more and more tests that you can run. And if you just keep testing, then eventually they'll come up with a diagnosis and they treat the diagnosis. It seems like medical professionals are not being taught at all to think critically and to look objectively at their patient. They're just looking at the lab results. So medicine's become very algorithmic. And instead of looking at the diagnosis, reaching for the pharmaceutical, we need to be looking at the patients and how can we correct the diet? How can we support? I mean, health is the natural state of the body. Like, it's not, medical practitioners are not, it's not their job to create health. Health is the natural state. Our job is to help get pets back to that natural state. But instead, they're focused on the symptom, stopping the symptom, or treating the lab result with pharmaceuticals.
I'm trying to imagine the scenario. So let's just say now I have a dog that's sick. He's clearly not well. And you have a clinic and I bring him to you. What is it that you would be doing differently?
First of all, a good history. Like when I first meet with a new client, I mean, it's almost an hour conversation. Most conventional vets, it's less than 10 minutes. So I want to know the full history. What's the vaccination history? What's the nutritional history? And put that together with what's showing up for the pet. And then, you know, there's levels of illness. Of course, there's true emergencies. Say dogs can get tumors on their spleen, for example, that can break open and bleed, and they can have a life-threatening bleed. So, you know, I would be assessing for an immediate life-threatening situation. That animal needs to go to surgery or they're going to die. You know, sometimes you need that kind of emergency intervention, but, you know, how sick is the animal? Do we have life-threatening symptoms? What's the history? Can we correlate something in the history with symptoms? So it's just a matter of putting everything together, not just throwing drugs at symptoms. Like a lot of times, itchy dogs, for example, see this a lot. And I think a lot of that's detoxification. The body will try to detox to the skin. We'll get skin rashes because the body's toxic. See, you know, itchy skin show up a lot after rounds of vaccinations. Well, on the conventional side, they're going to reach for an immunosuppressive medication that's just going to stop the itching. And the drugs are very effective. They can very effectively stop the itching, but you're not resolving the underlying issue. And that animal, a couple of years down the road, is going to end up with something worse, like cancer, because we're not allowing the body to resolve the underlying issue.
So that itchy dog shouldn't really be getting cortisone.
No, I don't think so. Sometimes in the very short term, because sometimes those poor dogs are so miserable and the more natural way takes time. So when dogs were like chewing holes in their skin because they're so itchy, very short term, just to give some temporary relief. Yes, but that's actually a pretty rare case. But yeah, I'm doing nutrition and herbs and all of those things to help rebalance the body.
You said herbs, but now a cat only eats meat. What happens in that situation?
Well, herbs can still be used to treat kitties. It's definitely more challenging. They're not as gullible. Dogs, it's a little easier to, you can hide a herb in a little treat or something, or even mix it in with their food. And a lot of times they'll eat it. So it's tricky. Sometimes we use tinctures. So you're just giving a liquid to a kitty. Cats are a little more challenging, but food-wise, definitely they should be eating a meat-based diet. But the thing is, a lot of times, like especially with skin stuff, if we correct the diet, we correct the skin issues. Sometimes if it takes longer, I think it's because the gut's been damaged. You know, you hear a lot about the microbiome. Pets need that healthy microbiome to be healthy. And I think skin health and gut health are always linked too. So we need to consider gut health.
Okay, so if I'm following your strategy correctly, you're not opposed to medical intervention if it's necessary, but your first prize is treating the animal holistically.
Absolutely. I would say conventional medicine for emergencies, short-term relief, keeping them comfortable. I always look at quality of life. And like, if we do need to intervene on the short term to preserve quality of life, then I would do that. But for long-term health, there's really no use for pharmaceuticals there.
What is an ideal environment then for the average dog or the average cat?
Nutrition, obviously, the most important. And I mean, I think lifestyle-wise, just allowing them to do what their species was meant to do. I mean, dogs love to go out and snip around and get out in nature. And even if it's hard to get them where they can run off leash, running off leash is probably ideal too. That's their natural state. That's not always possible, but just getting them out in nature where they can snip around and just be dogs. Cats like to chase things around. So if you're in the city and you can't get your cat outside, not too many cats get leash walked. I've seen some, but if you have a home, you can do a catio where they have these like outdoor enclosures where cats can get outside and they can see the birds and the bugs and all that stuff. And just providing things for them to chase. Cats love to chase things and play. And so that's enriching their environment in that way. I think it's really important. I think it's their mental health is really important. And I think it often gets overlooked.
That's a good point. Mental health in pets. I don't think it's something that the average person thinks about. Oh, it's just a dog. So, you know, we'll just give it food and take it to the doctor or whatever. But they do think and they do have feelings and they do experience the world. I'm not entirely certain how advanced their experience is. I mean, do you think dogs are self-aware?
I don't know. I mean, to what degree they might be self-aware, I don't know. I do know that they're much more in the moment. They're just very, like humans, you know, like we lament, like we're like, oh my gosh, I did this thing yesterday and now I'm thinking about it, you know, for the next 6 days. Like dogs, this is going on in this moment. They're eating, then they're playing their ball, then they're getting tummy rubs. You know, they're very much in the moment, much more so. I think we can learn a lot about that from our pets, to be honest. So I think they are very much in the moment, but they definitely remember if they have like a bad experience, especially as a puppy, they'll remember that if they're not treated well or something frightens them, they give a frightening experience in a certain circumstance, they'll remember that. But I think another really important thing is pets will take on the energy of their people. So when humans are very fearful or they're ill, I have seen many pets get the same health conditions as their humans do because they take on that energy. So if humans are stressed or worried about something, as much as they can de-stress themselves, they're also going to be helping the mental health of their pets.
Judy, pragmatically speaking, though, let's just say there are vets listening to this conversation. They don't want to lose their license because it's income and all that sort of thing. I mean, is there a way that they can integrate their conventional training with holistic ways of working with the pets?
You know, if they just started learning a little more about about the nutrition piece, if they just started there, that would be huge for their patients. Vets are not trained at all in nutrition. I think that's intentional. They're trained to sell these diets. The food companies and the pharmaceutical companies actually, you know, help fund the veterinary schools. And then the vets are trained to sell their products. So if they even just learned about nutrition, nobody's going to come take your license away if you're starting to introduce some new nutritional concepts to your patients. And there's good information out there these days. You know, you can find with the internet, you can find resources out there. I'm actually leaving tomorrow to go to the AHVMA. It's the American Holistic Veterinary Medical Association. So it's a national association of holistic vets. And their conference is in Reno this year. So I'm getting ready to go out there. And that's that organization is a great resource and the conference is a great resource. There's a lot of really great information there. So pick one thing. It's not like you have to change everything. I didn't change everything I was doing overnight. Right. Start to learn about nutrition. Pick one thing. You're kind of interested in herbs. Learn about a new herb every week. I mean, just start somewhere. And I can guarantee that any veterinarian that starts to introduce these principles into their practice is going to see some benefit to their patients.
I think like with human doctors, I suppose vets have also fallen into that sort of factory mindset. You know, let's get as many done in an hour so that we can turn a profit. It becomes a machine, but it does seem like that wheel is turning too fast now. I mean, it doesn't seem likely that it can be reversed.
Veterinarians need to realize that there's another way to practice. And that's one of the things that I'd like to start to teach vets. I mean, before I moved more into telemedicine, I just had a small practice out of my home and I did a lot. I didn't do surgery. I didn't do anything that required any kind of sedation because there's vets that do that. Like, I just wanted to offer the things that the other vets weren't doing. And I could do a lot out of a small space in my home. And I think, you know, a lot of vets, they're intimidated by being an entrepreneur because, you know, we don't have a business background typically, but you could do a small scale practice on your own very easily and just focus on the modalities that you really, really enjoy practicing. And then I think the practitioner is much happier and much more effective. And I think we all have, we go into medicine with a kind of our own unique gifts and our own areas where we're going to really shine as a practitioner. And I think that all gets squashed in corporatized medicine. Vets aren't allowed to express that. I think that's a big reason why suicide rates have gone up so much in veterinary medicine.
Very high.
Yeah. Hear are these statistics and it's really sad. And I think if vets realize there is a way where they could practice the things that they are really interested in, that are really beneficial, and that and they're really helping their patients heal, not just throwing drugs at symptoms, it's so much more rewarding and very feasible. You get out of vet school, I think, with this idea, I've learned all this stuff, I paid all this money, I got to do all these different things. It's like, you don't. Find the, you know, two or three things that you really enjoy doing, focus on that, and then you're going to really shine in that area, and you'll be so much happier.
I think here in South Africa, veterinary practice is an occupation that has one of the highest rates of suicide. And I wonder if that's similar in the US.
It is. I mean, I don't know exactly where it ranks with other professionals. I've heard it's gone up a lot in human medicine, especially through COVID. I'm sure there's a lot of practitioners that were conflicted about what was going on. But it's gone up for sure dramatically in the last couple of decades. Yeah, I think because of this dissatisfaction and being trapped in corporate medicine, you know, the vets get out of school with these huge debts sometimes, unless they, you know, have funding, family funding or something. But that's usually not the case. They're hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. They get a corporate job that has benefits and paid time off. But then they have to practice, you know, per the dictates of the corporation. And again, they're not allowed to really express themselves as a practitioner. And I think that creates a lot of internal conflict.
Have you found yourself personally being happier, waking up with more meaning and more purpose since you shifted your outlook?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And because I feel like, I mean, you know, I don't always have the, you know, success. I'd like to cure every cancer patient I see. Can't always do that because they're coming with different sets of circumstances. But I always feel like for some amount of time, I can improve their quality of life. Sometimes we have really great long-term results. But also as an entrepreneur, nobody's telling me how to practice or what I can use or what treatments. You know, have a case that's not responding and I do some research and I want to try a new herbal blend or some other form of therapy, I can use whatever I want. Whereas vets that are working in a corporate practice, they can only use, they have their list of medications, vaccinations, things that they can use. They can't even recommend other modalities, say acupuncture, chiropractic. If the clinic doesn't sell it, a lot of times those vets can't even talk to their clients about it.
I think I read somewhere or somebody told me that antibiotics and vaccines are upstream of pretty much everything in the pharmaceutical industry.
I would agree with that. And the vaccines, especially because they're started when animals and humans, I know human babies in the conventional hospital care, they start vaccinating them in the delivery room. And pets are often started, you know, 4, 5, 6 weeks. So they start kind of perpetuating this inflammation in the body, disrupting the normal immune system formation. And then antibiotics hammer the gut. We have to have good gut health and a healthy microbiome. You know, we're continuing learning more and more about how important that is. And anytime an antibiotic is given and you're killing off those beneficial bacteria in the gut, you're creating more chronic illness. And then you put this chronic inflammation and just toxicity from the vaccines on board. And the body just can't manage all that.
How can I find out more?
Well, you can certainly come to our website. We are ahavet.com. That's ahavet.com. We've got quite a bit of information there. We've got resources. I do quite a few podcasts with, I do a podcast with a raw dog food company in Colorado. We do those pretty much weekly. And so we talk about a lot of different medical issues there. I have a blog, so that would be a great place to start. I do have a Substack, which is judyjasekdvm.substack.com. I post a lot of other podcast interviews that I come across that I feel are useful, put that information out there. So those would be a couple of great places to start.
Judy Jasek, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
You're most welcome. I appreciate being here.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.